Okay, so today is October 12th, 2013. Okay, so we'll start with the homage to the Buddha. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato sammasambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato sammasambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato sammasambuddhassa. Okay, good morning, everybody. Okay, so we've been examining in the middle-length discourses sutta number 109. This is the Mahapunama Sutta, the greater discourse on the full moon night. And this is concerned with questions and answers on the five aggregates. Okay, so we've gone through the paragraph number 8 on the way the term aggregates applies to the five aggregates. So now we come to paragraph number 9, or section number 9. Here, the monk who is speaking questions the Buddha, what is the cause and condition for the manifestation of, well, for manifestation of each of the five aggregates. And so now with this question, in a way we are passing from a simple analysis of the five aggregates, and now we've come into, you could say, into the domain of dependent origination or conditionality. Okay, so the Buddha answers by taking each aggregate in turn, and so he starts with the aggregate of material form or rupa. So what is the cause and condition for the manifestation of the form aggregate? The four great elements are the cause and condition for the manifestation of the material form aggregate. Actually, the four great elements belong to the aggregate of material form. So I think we have to understand this in the sense that all the other constituents within the aggregate of material form are based upon the four primary elements. So what are the four primary elements that we already know? The earth element, water element, fire or heat element, and then the air or wind element. Then what are the types of form that will arise based on the four great elements? Some examples of secondary material form. Johnny, you know?
I should know. I remember you mentioned that before. It's my heart, all my body part is considered secondary.
Well, I think you could say that the four great elements are also in the physical body. So not everything in the physical body is secondary. Any guess? Just take a chance. Stephen.
What would be the qualities of those elements, like solidity and liquidity?
No, those solidity, liquidity, those are just more precise ways of explaining the characteristics of the four great elements. But when the four great elements combine, then certain other properties or types of material phenomena emerge.
So what do you mean by secondary?
Well, this is just the term that's used, derivative. Types of matter based on the four great elements.
A mountain.
Excuse me?
A mountain. A mountain?
I didn't catch the word.
A mountain?
A mountain, no. The mountain, you say, is a combination of the four great elements. You're wrong.
Are you talking about the first five of the six sense bases?
Right. That's very good. That's in the types of secondary matter. So within the eye, what we call the eye, there's a special type of matter which is said to be sensitive to forms. Within the ear, there's a certain type of matter which is sensitive to sounds. Similarly, within the nose, not this part that comes out here, but up at the top of the inside of the nostrils, there's a type of material phenomena which is sensitive to odors. And then spread out through the tongue, there is, well, I think we would call them in modern terms, taste buds. These would be like the nerve endings that are sensitive to different tastes. And then spread out through the surface of the body and also on the inside of the body, maybe in the membranes, there is a sensitivity to tactile sensations. Okay, so that's a class of types of derivative matter. Then there's some other types of derivative matter that correspond to these. That would be color, sound, odor, flavor. And then it's said in the Abhidhamma that the tactile object are the great elements themselves. But it seems to me that, I don't know, I would distinguish and say that there is a tactile sense or tactile objects which are based on the four great elements but not identical with them. Okay, so that's enough to get some idea of what's meant by secondary matter. But you can make notes of these, so next time when I ask, everybody will be able to tell me immediately. Okay, then there's a, while we're still in the form aggregate, there's a special relationship between the four primary elements themselves, which is mentioned, is actually developed formally within the Abhidhamma, but I think it's already implicit in the suttas, and that is that the four great elements are called, as a technical term, anya-manya-pachaya, which means that they are mutual conditions for one another. This means that each of the four great elements depends on the other three great elements. And each of the great elements in turn functions as a condition for the other three great elements. So the four great elements are a little bit like, maybe you could say they're like the four legs of one of these chairs. So the chair can stand only when all four legs are keeping it upright. If you remove one of the legs, the chair will tumble down. And so the four great elements support each other. And we could say that the derivative type of matter is like maybe the seat of the chair, which depends upon the support of all four legs, and the back of the chair, which also depends upon all four legs. Of course, you could take the legs away and the seat and the back will still be there, but it wouldn't be functioning as a chair anymore. But in the case of the four great elements, it's impossible to remove one without eliminating the others. Maybe we could have scientists with one of these giant colliders like they have someplace in Switzerland. And I think there's another one underground in Texas shooting photons, is it? Some kind of micro atomic particle, shooting them at at the compound of the four great elements, trying to knock away one of the four elements and see if they could do that without destroying the other three. But if they do that, then the other three great elements will dissolve into quarks or something like that. Okay, so the four great elements are the condition for the material form aggregate. And now for the feeling aggregate, the perception aggregate, and the aggregate of volitional formations, they all have the same condition, and that condition is what we call, in Pali, it's pasa, which is here translated contact. And how do we understand pasa, contact? It's explained in the suttas as the coming together of three things. Well, actually, I think I've explained it last week. That is, it's the coming together of object, sense faculty, and consciousness. But the way I like to understand it is it's the meeting of consciousness with the object through the medium of the sense faculty. Or we could say that it's conscious. Sometimes we speak about the sense faculties as being doors. We use the Pali word dwara. So we could say it's like the consciousness goes out through the door in order to meet the object. So when a form comes into range, then I can say that consciousness goes out through the door of the eye to meet the visible form object. And when the consciousness sort of shakes hands with the form, that is contact. Or we could think of the object coming in through the door of the sense faculty and meeting the consciousness. So it's like the first the object knocks on the door, then if one pays attention to the knocking, then one says, come in, and the object comes in and meets the consciousness inside, you would say, inside the mind. And so that coming together of the mind or consciousness with the object is contact. And as soon as contact takes place, three other things occur simultaneously with the contact. First, one experiences the object in some way as being, one experiences the tone or flavor of the object. That means one experiences the object, if it has a really distinctive flavor, then one experiences it as either pleasant. If it's a disagreeable object, then one experiences it as painful or disagreeable. And then if it's neither agreeable nor disagreeable, then one experiences it with a kind of neutral flavor. So we could say that when the object is agreeable, it's like drinking a nice cup of well-brewed coffee in the morning. If you like coffee, or having a nice milkshake, if you like that. or a fine French wine. If it's a disagreeable object, it's like drinking a cup of thoroughly brewed Chinese herbal tea or Indian herbal tea, medicinal herb. And if it's neutral, then it's, you know, like you drink a cup of water. You never really notice the flavor. Okay, so first, or at least one thing that one experiences the flavor of the object by way of its feeling, then there takes place at some level, it can be very quick, almost below the threshold of full awareness, but there takes place some noticing of the object. If the object is cognized by consciousness, then there is some way of identifying the object, or at least picking up the characteristic, the mark of the object. And that is what is called perception. So perception is can be a very subtle grasping of the characteristic, the mark, the sign of the object, by which one, if that perception builds up and becomes more sophisticated, then one can define the object, categorize it, explicitly identify it to oneself. And if it's something one has seen before, then there will take place, or can take place, a recognition of the object based on a previous perception. So all of this is the work of this third aggregate, which is sanya, or perception. Okay, so those are two events that take place. The third event within this group of three is in response to the object. Even with the initial contact, there takes place some way of responding to it. That is, there takes place some intention or volition in regard to the object. And so that is the most basic member of the aggregate of volitional formations. That is, in Pali, it's called chetana, volition. And so through the volition, one responds to the object. One can utilize the object in some way. For example, when I have this cup in front of me, first I see it, so that is perception. And then what takes place more prominently, slightly afterwards, is the intention of taking a drink. And so with the perception of the cup, then there comes the volition to reach for the cup, grasp it, move it towards me, and take a drink from the cup. Okay, so these are the three aggregates that arise based on contact, feeling, perception, an initial volition, and then associated with this initial volition or based on it, there can arise a whole crowd or assemblage of mental reactions. For example, when one likes something, then greed can arise. I want to have more. Or if one doesn't like something, then one can arise aversion. If the drink is really bitter, then I want to push it away, or I say, get rid of it. Or else if I know it's medicine, then I have to convince myself it's good for you, drink it anyway. So all of these types of mental activities come within the group of sankhara khanda, the group of volitional activities. And where does contact come? In terms of the five aggregates. Take a guess.
Sorry, the same question again.
Where does contact come in the five aggregates?
Before feelings and after material form?
Yeah, but in which of the aggregates would we put it? Any other ideas?
I think it's more than one, right? So it would be the material aggregate and the feeling aggregate.
Any other ideas?
Consciousness.
Okay, anyway, it's a trick question. Since within the suttas, contact is never assigned to any of the five aggregates. It's sort of left unclassified. So then, when the Abhidhamma came into existence, because the compilers of the Abhidhamma had to put all the mental factors mentioned in the suttas into one or another of the five aggregates, so they put it into the aggregate of the sankhara khanda, the aggregate of volitional activities. Even though it's not really a volitional activity itself, but they treat the sankhara khanda as a kind of, maybe call it a collection box to put all the other mental factors apart from feeling, perception, and consciousness. Okay, so now we come to the last of the five aggregates, And then the last aggregate is vijnana. This is consciousness. And what is the condition for consciousness? The condition for consciousness is said to be nama rupa, which is translated here, mentality, materiality. So we have nama rupa. And the rupa part is obviously identical with the aggregate of material form. And then according to the suttas, what is meant by nama? It explains nama as consisting of, it includes, contact. Feeling, perception, volition, and it also includes attention. So if we just put aside for now contact and attention, we could see that feeling, perception, volition make up the three middle aggregates. And so this means that consciousness arises in dependence on material form or the body and the other three mental aggregates. And so consciousness, whenever there's consciousness occurring, it's occurring at least within the human realm, within our own experience, it's always occurring based upon the physical body. It's occurring through one or another of the sense faculties, or else if it's not occurring through one of the outer physical sense faculties, it's occurring, in modern terms, we would say, based upon activity of the brain. And then the consciousness is always associated with some kind of feeling, some kind of perception, and some kind of intention or volitions. And in turn, one would say that the other four aggregates, always occur in dependence upon consciousness. Of course, you could have, when you have a dead body, there's no consciousness, and so you could say that there is form there, but it's just inorganic or dead matter. But for there to be a living body, there has to be consciousness. And whenever there is and for there to be feeling, perception, and volition, there has to be consciousness. You can't have any kind of feeling, any kind of perception, any kind of volition without vijnana, without consciousness. And so this is why in some suttas, consciousness and name and form are compared to two stacks of hay, which might be put in a field, by a farmer, so that the two stacks of hay are supporting each other. If you pull away the stack of hay on the left, then the one on the right will fall. And if one pulls away the stack of hay on the right, the one on the left will fall. So name and form and consciousness are also anyamanya pachayas, that is, mutual conditions, conditions that support one another. Okay, so that's the way this sutta is explaining the causes and conditions for the manifestation of the five aggregates. Any questions at this point?
I just want to have a statement.
Take the microphone.
You said what I was going to say about the condition, mutuality condition, but it's also a connaissance condition, how the aggregates arise from one another, right?
Connaissance. Yeah, but this is getting a bit technical, yeah. Okay, that's an important question. According to some suttas, all the four mental aggregates occur together simultaneously. So whenever there's some feeling, at the same time there's some perception, there's some volitional activities, and so with each one. But within our own experience, the way we see it or observe it, on certain occasions, one of the aggregates might be more prominent, more dominant, and the other aggregates would be somewhat subordinate or secondary or supporting. For example, if I stub my toe when I'm walking, say, then what becomes prominent on that occasion is the feeling of pain. So then the aggregate of feeling is dominant. Then I might think, when the pain subsides a little bit, then I might think, how did I stub my toe? Then I see that maybe there was a log or a stick left on the road. So then I might, when I notice the stick on the road, that would be perception. So there's still some feeling, still some volition, but what's prominent on that occasion is the perception aggregate. Then I think, well, I should ensure that other people don't trip over this log in the future. And so then I decide I should move this little log to the side of the road. And so then I bend down, take the log, and move it aside. On that occasion, what's prominent is volition. So volition is what moves me to take some action. And so at all those occasions, all those three aggregates are occurring, but first, in this series, first there's the feeling aggregate, then the perception becomes more prominent, then the volition comes in. Barbara, you?
Yes, I had an experience years ago when I was hiking, and I'm not even sure I was aware of the sound.
Yeah.
What I knew was the next thing I was in the air screaming. Then I recognized I had heard a rattle.
You had heard a rattle.
Yeah, and I don't know rattlesnakes, but I knew I was responding to that sound. And yes, there was a little rattlesnake in the path.
Yeah.
But I've always thought of it as a thing where we can respond even when there's no consciousness involved, when the mind isn't involved.
Yeah. Yeah.
And it was kind of a tracing, like you just ran through it, of, oh, that was, I jumped because I heard something.
Yeah, yeah.
So I put it together piece by piece. Because it seemed like I went right to volition, right, in the terms that we're using now.
Yeah, maybe it seems like that, but maybe what took place at a very, very rapid level would be a very quick, sudden perception of the snake, but it's before, it's at a level where you're not explicitly, clearly, you know, conceptually able to identify it as a snake. But it's like maybe what we would call like a subliminal perception. For example, like advertisers, well, I don't know if they still do this, but there was a thing in the 1950s where, like, if you go to the movies, you know, suddenly you get a desire as you're watching the movie to go back to the refreshment stand to buy a Coke. And then when you slow down, when they would slow down the frames of the movie, they find that the advertisers, what they're doing is putting in some frames that everything goes better with Coke. And so it just flashes by, and so without that frame flashes by too quickly for us to be able to explicitly identify it, but just at some level the mind is picking up on that and it's making the impression which is motivating you to go back and buy the Coke. They call it subliminal advertising.
That's a good point. I want to talk about, like, for example, breathing. Is consciousness involved in breathing? Because I only see it involved with mindfulness. But usually, if you're not mindful, sometimes you don't even perceive.
Yeah, I'd say consciousness is not essential to breathing. That the breathing goes on automatically.
Or anything like that supports itself, like maybe a reflex.
Yeah, those go on without consciousness being involved. Did you have a question? And is that Sunil? Oh, long time. Oh, the difference between attention and mindfulness. Yeah. So sometimes some people like explained what we would call sati, which is translated as mindfulness. Sometimes they explain that as attention. But what is meant here by attention is the initial act of turning the mind to an object. So if there's something which suddenly, you know, attracts your attention, and then you turn the mind to that object, that's what is meant by attention here. Whereas mindfulness is deliberately keeping the object present to the mind. So mindfulness involves a degree of deliberation or strong intention. Whereas attention, in this sense, is something that happens almost spontaneously, automatically. Okay, I want to move on since we want to finish the sutta today. We could take more questions later, either later today or after the lunch period. Okay, because now we come to the very important section, because the reason why the Buddha brings up the teaching of the five aggregates is not to engage in a kind of abstract or purely academic analysis of experience. But the reason why he focuses so often on the five aggregates is because the five aggregates are a way of classifying the different bases from which there arises the view of a self. And the view of a self is what is called in Pali Sakkaya Ditti. And it's here what's translated identity view. Okay, so Sakkaya Ditti view means a view of something called Sakkaya. Sakkaya is a word very difficult to translate into English. Even the Chinese didn't do such a good job with it, since they just translated it usually as shun, just meaning body. But it comes from a prefix sak or sat, which means existing, and kaya, of course, means body. But it's not referring only to the physical body, but sakkaya is the collection of the five aggregates, or we could say the assemblage of the five aggregates. So that is the existing body. Okay, so we have the five aggregates which make up Sakkaya, the assemblage or one's personal identity, and then there is a view of a self in regard to this assemblage of the five aggregates. And according to the formula in the suttas, the view of a self in relation to the five aggregates can take any of four, can occur in any of four modes in relation to each of the five aggregates. And so we have this in paragraph 10. How does identity view come to be? Or maybe better, what is identity view? Okay, then the Buddha answers and he says, and he speaks about the untaught ordinary person or the uninstructed worldly person who has no regard for the noble ones and is unskilled and untrained in their teaching. So this one, the ordinary, unenlightened person of the world, will regard taking material form as the example. He'll regard form as the self, or the self as something separate from form, which possesses it. So the self is the owner of material form, or else he can regard material form as in the self, or the self as in material form. And so if we let X represent any of the five aggregates, Then we have self equals X, self owns X. What's the third one? Self is in X. No, it's X is in the self. And then the last is the self is in X, where X can represent any of the five aggregates. And so some of the text gives some examples to illustrate, or at least similes to illustrate some of these types of identity view. For example, the self owns the aggregate, just as a farmer might own five cows. So the farmer is different from the cows, but the farmer is the owner of the cows. Then the self is, or the aggregate is in the self. This is like the view of a great big universal self, and then everything exists within that universal self. So this is like the self is like a box, and then the aggregates are like the different items that one puts in the box. So the self might be like a jeweled box, because one considers the self very precious. And the five aggregates might be like, maybe like coins that one puts in the box. And then the view that the self is in consciousness, or the self is in the aggregate, this is the view that maybe the self is something like very subtle that exists somewhere within the innermost core of the person. This was a view that became very prominent in the thought of the Upanishads, which existed in India at the time of the Buddha, that it said that when you look into the innermost depths of the person, you strip away everything else, the body, the feelings, the thoughts, the volitions, even the consciousness or the superficial consciousness. At the innermost core, you come to the eternal, immutable, unchangeable, pure awareness, which is the true eternal self. And so this is like a jewel, maybe encased within some kind of maybe a ball of clay, and inside the ball of clay there is a very precious jewel. Okay, and so those are the 20 kinds of identity view. Maybe different people have different inclinations to one or another of these views. So I sometimes think that, like, maybe athletes who are very much concerned about having a strong, powerful body, or fashion models, or beauty queens who are very much concerned about physical beauty, for them there's a very strong identification with the body as self. Then other types of people very much attached to their feelings, maybe very sensitive to pain and strongly addicted to pleasant feelings, maybe like gourmets who like to eat very delicious foods, maybe very sensitive, I don't know, maybe you could help me fill these out. Then we have the perception, maybe this would be the artist, the painter, photographer who's very, you know, concerned to get very splendid pictures by finding the exact scene for a photograph.
Musician.
Yeah, I think musicians seem to hover somewhere between perception and feeling, because I'd say that the feeling component in music is more prominent, at least it used to be. Now when you get to things like rap and hip-hop and heavy metal rock. It seems what's prominent has become volition to drive people crazy. Okay, then with the aggregate of volitional activities, that would be the kind of person, you know, setting up my business, I'm going to be a success in business, going to build up the company, make it really powerful, you know, buy out this competitor, that competitor, make my mark on the world. Or the aspiring politician who first runs in local elections, wins the local elections and runs in the state elections, then goes into the national elections, then before long he is running for congressman, senator, president, or he becomes cabinet member, somebody who's going to, you know, impose his will and shape the world according to his will. Then how about the aggregate of consciousness? That's a good idea. Yeah. You could think like the very astute philosophers, the thinkers.
Meditators.
Yeah. Even though the idea is to get free from identification, but one wants to experience maybe altered states of consciousness, higher states of consciousness. Or I remember in the 1960s, didn't we have something called the consciousness movement? You got to change your consciousness, man. Take a couple of these, smoke a little of that. Okay, so this is identity view. And then identity view, the aim of the Buddha's teaching, at least one of the aims, is to get free from identity view. And at what stage, how does one get free from identity view? At what point does one get free from identity view? Completely. Yeah, exactly. It's at, we call the first breakthrough to the Dharma. That is the stage of stream entry that one sees into the truth of anatta, the truth of selflessness. And so by seeing selflessness very clearly, then one cuts off even the subtlest trace of identity view. And so identity view, if you remember the 10 fetters, the 10, you know, bonds that keep us in bondage to samsara, the first of the 10 fetters is identity view, or sakkaya ditti. And so with the breakthrough to the truth of the Dhamma, then one eradicates identity view, so that one can never identify any of the five aggregates explicitly as being myself. But even the stream enterer, the once returner, the non-returner, still have a kind of subtle clinging to the five aggregates, even taking them sort of spontaneously to be I and mine, though they won't build upon those ideas of I and mine to think that the five aggregates are myself. Okay, so this is actually what is meant in the next paragraph on how identity view does not come to be. That is, it's with the attainment of the first stage of awakening, the stage of stream enterer, that one becomes completely free from any kind of identity view. Okay, then the monk asked the Buddha, what is the gratification, danger, and escape in the case of each of the five aggregates? And then the Buddha, for all of them, he gives basically the same answer, that the pleasure and joy that arise in dependence on material form and so on, that is the gratification in the case of material form, and so on. So the fact that any of these five aggregates can function as the basis for pleasure, physical bodily pleasure, or joy, mental pleasure, delight, happiness, exaltation, that is the enjoyment or gratification in them. And that gratification, that is the basis for clinging to them. So we cling to the aggregate, hold to it, become attached to it because of the pleasure and joy that arise from it. Then what is the danger, the drawback, the disadvantage in each of the five aggregates? And the answer is that each of the aggregates is impermanent, and then it's suffering, maybe here it isn't the right word, it's dukkha in the sense of being unsatisfactory. That is, it can't give true, permanent satisfaction. So it's impermanent, it's unsatisfactory or deficient, and it's subject to change, that is, subject to disagreeable change, change in the direction of deterioration, decay. And so that is the dissatisfaction, or what's the word that I use, the danger in the case of the five aggregates. And so it's by turning our attention away from the gratification to the danger or disadvantage in the five aggregates that one develops detachment from them, that one moves in the direction of nibbida, viraga, vimutti, that is, in the direction of disenchantment, dispassion, and liberation from the five aggregates. And then the third question is, what is the escape, or maybe the release, the outlet from the five aggregates? And then the Buddha answers that it is the removal of desire and lust, the abandoning of desire and lust to the five aggregates. That is the escape, the release, the outlet from the five aggregates. So the movement, there's actually, I call this like a three-step process, a three-step process of development. So we move from considering the gratification or enjoyment to the five in the five aggregates to reflection on the danger in the five aggregates. And this is a kind of meditation. You know, the meditation is not only observing one's breath, observing the sensations in the body, but it's also involves some degree of reflection or sustained systematic examination of the danger in the five aggregates. For example, in bodily form, you know, we think, well, we have the body when it's young and strong and healthy, then we can enjoy, you know, wonderful sights through the eye. We want to go to, you know, I haven't been to the Grand Canyon, I want to see it. I want to go to Niagara Falls and see it. I want to go to visit Los Angeles or Europe or China, Japan, to see everything. And then one wants to enjoy all the pleasures through the senses. And that way one gets gratification. But then, even if one is young, one can reflect that this body will grow old, it falls sick, it's subject to decay, to many types of illnesses. And so one reflects on the danger in material form. Then there will come some distancing from the body, some disenchantment with the body. And it's through that reflection on the danger in the five aggregates that one begins to move away from them, to remove the desire and attachment to them. Okay, so this is the questionnaire on gratification, danger, and escape. Then Section 13, we come to the question, how does one know, how does one see, so that in regard to this body and its consciousness and all external signs, or we could say more clearly, all external objects, there is no eye-making, mind-making, and underlying tendency to conceit. So this is the way to eliminate what I would call notions of subjectivity or notions related to the sense of self. That is, the notions regarded to a sense of self take the form of eye-making, mind-making, and the tendency to conceit. So we can say that eye-making This is the mental process by which one constructs the idea of an I, of a real self, and then builds up notions of I based on that sense of self. So I-making, we could say, is identical to a view of self, or the view of a real I. an I which in some way is separate from the five aggregates, or identical with them, or possesses them, and so on. Then there's mind-making. This is generally the work of craving. Because when you have craving, then you want to sort of extend the idea of what one possesses ever more widely and bring everything with it that's possible into the scope of mind. And then there's the tendency to conceit. This is generally referring first, at the first level, to the conceit. I am. And then on the basis of conceit, one starts comparing oneself to others and measuring oneself in relation to others, thinking I'm better than he is, I am equal on the same level as this one or that one. Or else in Buddhism we have the notion of the inferiority conceit, that is, oh, I'm not as good as them. Why does it always happen to me? I just should just give up. It's pointless to try to do anything or accomplish anything. Everything I try just gets screwed up. I seem to have been born with a heavy load on my back. That's the kind of inferiority conceit. So a lot of people actually have that, particularly in America, where we're always sort of given to this Hollywood, these images of the ideal. The ideal hero is the tough guy with strong, who could lick anybody in the neighborhood. And then the ideal woman is the one who has particular blonde hair or sparkling blue eyes, big, big breasts, the hourglass figure. And so then people, men and women, rate themselves against the ideal types, and then they feel that they are losers. And then also we have the standard of success. You have to be a success. And then if you don't measure up, then you feel miserable. Okay, so he's asking, how does one eliminate this eye-making, mind-making, and tendency to conceit? Okay, and then the Buddha explains or answers with this is sort of the standard meditation on anatta, on non-self. So whatever kind of material form there is, whether past, present, or future, wow, typographical mistake I never noticed before. It just says whether past or present, it should be three. It should be past, present, or future. Okay, so anyway, so he says, any kind of material form, whatever, whether past, present, or future, internal or external, gross or subtle, inferior or superior, far or near, one sees all material form as it actually is with samapanyaya, with correct wisdom. Thus, this is not mine, this I am not, this is not myself. Any kind of feeling, whatever, any kind of perception, whatever, any kind of mental formations, whatever, any kind of consciousness, whatever, whether past, present, or future, internal or external, gross or subtle, inferior or superior, far or near, one sees all consciousness as it actually is with correct wisdom. Thus, this is not mine, this I am not, this is not myself. It is when one knows and sees thus that in regard to this body with its consciousness and all external objects, there is no I-making through this view of self, no constructing the idea of a real, essential, substantial I. There is no mind-making, no craving to get more and more things and stamp on them the label. This is the property of Bhikkhu Bodhi. Anybody who touches it will be prosecuted to the full extent of the law. And there will be no tendency to conceit, no thinking, I'm the best, number one, or I am just as good as they are. And no thinking, what a miserable failure I am. Never as good as anybody else. So this is extremely practical, extremely useful reflection. You know, if you do your meditation every day and you take this first, writing it out and reading it silently to yourself at the end of your meditation, don't think that you're losing your meditation time, wasting it on reading. But this is actually a practice that is starting to wear away the I-making, mind-making, and tendency to conceit. So when you do this, it's like using sandpaper. You want to make something smooth, or you want to get like rid of a bump. You know, you've made out of some lumber, you've made maybe a table, but there are still some bumps on the table and you want to make the surface smooth. So you take a piece of sandpaper and rub the surface of the table, and little by little, with each rubbing, you're removing those bumps till the surface becomes smooth. And so when you do this analytical or reflective contemplation on non-self, you're helping to sort of wear away or cut away the idea of self or the grasping of I and mine. Or again, it's like you want to cut down a tree or chop down a tree. It's like you take a hatchet, an axe, and you chop at the bottom of the tree, the lower part of the trunk, and as you're chopping, chips of wood are falling away until you reach a point where enough wood has been chopped away, and then you just have to give a little push to the tree and it comes tumbling down. And so when you do this, you sort of, little by little, you are wearing away all the mental tendencies or the defilements that revolve around the ideas of I and mine, and you are paving the road to the penetration of selflessness. And this also comes in very handy in day-to-day life, because when you do this contemplation, you know, sometimes people praise you, and if you're not, your mind isn't trained, then you get proud. They said I gave a very interesting class today, or else they blame you. You look out at the audience and a few people in the back. And then you get upset. Oh, I'm giving such a boring class. Oh, I must be such a boring speaker. I must be such a boring person. I. But if you do this regularly, you go on speaking the same, whether everybody is looking interested and taking notes, or everybody in the room is just lying there. No difference. Or else sometimes you get what you want. You know, if you're doing business, you succeed, get a raise, get a promotion. So instead of getting proud because of that, of course you accept it, but you take it in stride. And then I hope it doesn't happen, but if you get laid off from the job, then again you can take it, you know, just as due to conditions. That's the nature of the economy now. It doesn't mean I have to blame myself and sort of beat and whip myself for getting laid off. And if you get very sick, like sometimes this is the case with myself, you know that I have this really, sometimes this head pain condition, which sometimes becomes really just so painful that all I can do is just lie down or sit in the armchair. And often I've used this reflection that whatever feeling arises, whether painful or pleasant, it's just not mine, not I, not myself. So if you get really ill, you could bring in that reflection. And then maybe the most important of all is when you're lying on your deathbed. You know, if you're clinging to the idea, I'm going to die. I won't be here anymore. I. Then there comes great fear or stress or grief, anxiety. But if you just sort of turn back and reflect the five aggregates, not mine, not I, not myself, then you can just let them go. Just like the Buddha uses a simile in one of the other suttas, it's like he was speaking in Jeta's Grove Monastery when some of the wood gatherers come and they take the fallen branches and logs from the woods and they remove them from the grounds of the monastery. You don't think they're taking me away, they're removing I. They're removing myself. But they're just removing pieces of fallen wood. And so you could look at the five aggregates in the same way, even at the time of death. If you want to find out whether or not it works, when I die, then you can come and ask me. Okay, so while the Buddha was speaking in this way, then it says that a certain monk who was sitting there in the audience gave rise to this thought. He thought, material form is not self, feeling, perception, volitions, consciousness is not self. What self, then, will the actions done by the not self affect? So this monk, it seems, was clinging to some view of a self separate from the five aggregates. So he could see that, or at least he would accept that the five aggregates are not self. But still, because of his strong clinging, he believed that there must be some self that is existing now and that will reap the results of the karma done by the not self. Okay, so while the Buddha was speaking, then he understood the thought in the mind of this monk, and then he said, it's possible that, here he speaks rather strongly, I think, that some misguided man who is obtuse and ignorant, with his mind dominated by craving or in the grip of craving, might think he can outstrip the teaching of the master thus by raising that question. And then the Buddha says, now, monks, haven't you been trained by me through interrogation or question on various occasions in regard to various matters? And then the Buddha, now he's taking the monks in a kind of sequential way through the three characteristics. Instead of hitting directly on the non-self, he proceeds through the three characteristics, from impermanence to suffering and then to non-self. And then he brings in again that we have come to paragraph 16. Again, he brings in that same passage, and here we have it correctly. Any kind of material form, whatever, whether past, future, or present, any kind of feeling, perception, volitions, consciousness, all consciousness should be seen as it really is, with proper wisdom. This is not mine. This I am not. This is not myself. So that is the insight into non-self. Seeing thus, the well-instructed, noble disciple becomes disenchanted with form, feeling, perception, volitional formations, consciousness. When he's dispassionate, when he's disenchanted, he becomes dispassionate. When he's dispassionate, his mind is liberated. And when it's liberated, there comes the knowledge of liberation. And he knows the round of rebirths has been finished. The spiritual life has been lived. What had to be done has been done. There is no more coming back to any state of being. And so that ends the statement by the Buddha, but then the sutta adds, or the narrative adds, another event that took place. It says that the monks were satisfied and delighted in the Buddha's words, and while the discourse was being spoken, through not clinging, 60 monks liberated their minds from the asavas through not clinging. So we usually get that statement when the Buddha gives a very powerful discourse. And so here, with 60 monks who were sitting there, as they were listening to the Buddha, reflecting on his words, they applied his teaching to their own experience, and right on the spot, they achieved arhatship, the liberation of the mind from the defilements. Okay, we won't have time for questions in this session, but we'll break for lunch now, and if you have questions, please come back after lunch, and then we can discuss the questions. Okay, so let us end with the sharing of the merits. Okay, so we share the merits with the devas, the nagas, the buddhas, wishing them to be well and happy and free from harm and suffering. Akasata chabumata adeva naga mahitika punyantang anumoditva chirang rakantu sasanam. Akasata chabumata deva naga mahitika punyantang anumoditva chirang rakantu desanam. Akasata chabumata deva naga mahitika punyantang anumoditva Chirang Rakantu Mang Parang Eta Vatacham Hehi Sampadang Punya Sampadam Sabe Devanumodantu Sabha Sampati Siddhya Eta Vatacham Hehi Sampadang Punya Sampadam Sabe Bhutanumodantu Sabha Sampati Siddhya Eta Vatacham Hehi Sampadang Punya Sampadam Sabe Satanu Modantu Sabha Sampati Siddhya Bhavagupadaya Vichihetato Etantare Satakai Upapana Rupi Arupicha Asanya Sanino Dukha Pamuchantu Pusantu Nibhutin. Okay, before we end, I want to mention first that we won't have a class next week because I'll be going to hear the Dalai Lama give lectures in New York City. Then the week after that, I'm sorry, but we won't have a class because I'll be joining the BGR walk in Connecticut. And then the week after that also, I'm really sorry, but we won't have a class because then I'll be joining the walk in New York City. And while I mention this, I also want to mention that for the walk in New York City, we need a few volunteers to help with the walk. And if any of you are free that day and can come for the walk, please also volunteer to help. Some of the roles would be like, we call them the shepherds or marshals to make sure everybody is walking at an even pace, helping to man like the desk where people register, some other jobs.
What date is that date?
Excuse me?
What date?
This is November 2nd. It's a Saturday. And the registration begins at 9:30 or even earlier, 9:15 a.m. And the whole walk procedure continues. After the walking, then we have a little ceremony with some talks, or actually we have a little just concluding ceremony to share the merits. Then we have a lunch, and then after the lunch, some talks, Dharma talks. And this is a way of, by which our organization, Buddhist Global Relief, raises funding to sponsor our projects through the next fiscal year of basically supporting different projects that will relieve hunger and malnutrition around the world. So if you are free that day and would like to serve in some capacity, which is a great, I should also say, is a great source of merit, you can speak to either Johnny or Sandy here. And I emphasize the point that we do need some volunteers. So any kind of help will be welcomed. Okay, so let us end with the bows to the Buddha, three half bows.
Thank you.